Turn your tax refund into a new garage door at Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Increase your home's value with a new Ideal garage door. From traditional to modern, Menards has a garage door to enhance your home's appearance. Choose from our large in-stock selection or design your own using our free garage door design program. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Formula One is a speed, glamour, danger, and eye-watering wealth. Driven, the men who made Formula One, tells how a small group of extraordinary men transformed Formula One into a niche sport, played out on primitive tracks surrounded by hay bales and grass verges, into a 1 billion circus performing in vast theatres of entertainment all over the world. The book is called Driven. It's written by Kevin Easton. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Kevin himself. Kevin, good morning to you.
Morning.
So, it's quite a tale, isn't it, if you think how motor racing began, and the first, because next year is the anniversary of the first World Championship Grand Prix at Silverstone, from a couple of, you know, gentlemen racing round a track made of hay bales into something like the Abu Dhabi at the end of the season.
Yeah, I think the thing about Formula One that people possibly don't appreciate is that it's unique. You know, something like football has a history of about 160, 170 years, and the game is pretty much recognisable now as it was then. Same with cricket. If W.G. Grace walked into Lord's on Sunday, he would have recognised, apart from the size of the crowds perhaps, but he'd have recognised the game. But Formula One has changed in the last 60-odd years out of all recognition, from being a largely amateurish sport with just a few manufacturers. A very small group of men transformed it into this enormous global product. And they've always boasted that after the Olympics and the World Cup, it's the most watched global sport. And it is really the story of just a dozen or so guys. I've had the privilege of knowing most of them quite well over a period of about 25 years. And people always used to ask me what they were like. And so, you know, what did they do? Oh, that's funny, they said that. And they said, you should write it down. So I did, and that's in the book.
When you talk about a small group of men, one of the smallest of that small group is, of course, Bernie Eccleston. He's quite a figure. Now, what was his background? Because he has been the driving force behind Formula One, basically, since he took over Brabham, wasn't it, in the mid-70s or the early 70s?
Well, he is possibly the most remarkable character I've ever met and probably ever will meet. I mean, he started in a very small village up in Suffolk, St. Peter's. His father was a The family moved down to South London, and right from the start, he was an entrepreneur. He used to sell pens and buns to his playground schoolmates. He then started stripping down old motorcycles and selling them on. Then he graduated to a car showroom, and then he got interested in racing. He did a bit of racing himself, although he wasn't tremendously good. He had a lot of accidents, apparently, which is why he packed it in. And then people probably won't know this, but he was the manager to a couple of drivers who both tragically were killed at the track. So he was steeped in Formula One as a young man. And he was already a millionaire when he bought the Brabham team in 1970, I think it was. And from there, he saw the inner workings of Formula One and realized that here was something that he could make special. And he brought, he's a bit autistic, I think, because he's one of these guys, everything has to be straight, neat, you know, in a line, polished, nice and shiny. And he brought that obsession to the sport. And what you see now on the track is really a product of his imagination.
Because at that time, say the late 60s to the early 70s, motor racing had basically been, if you like, run off the hoof by national organisations. So, you know, the French would run their Grand Prix, the BRDC would run Silverstone or Brands Hatch or wherever they were. It was very much a sort of, you turned up and they were making it on the hoof almost.
Yeah, I mean, it was all very ad hoc. In fact, the very first World Championship race, which is in 1950 at Silverstone, Enzo Ferrari didn't bother to turn up because he didn't think the prize money was good enough. Whereas Bernie locked all of the teams into contracts, which meant that they must turn up. And in return, he told the circuits that they would have a minimum number of cars at every race, so they knew what they were planning for. But then he hit on this idea of having the circuits pay to have the show arrive, and that is really where the money started to roll in. And then in 1976, when the famous Lauda Hunt season came about and we had the great showdown in Japan, Niki Lauda recovering from an absolutely horrific accident in which he could have died, and people will have seen the movie, I'm sure, when he recovered, came back to fight out the world championship with James Hunt at the very last race of the season. Bernie thought, this is major box office, and he started to tie in the TV companies into big contracts. And from there, the ball started to roll, and he realised that he was creating something.
It wasn't just him as well, though, because he didn't do it all on his own. He had, if you like, he had lieutenants or generals to his left and the right, including Max Mosley. Now, how did Max come into Bernie's orbit?
Well, Max was an extraordinary character with a brilliant, brilliant mind. He was trained as a lawyer, and his wife was given a couple of tickets to Silverstone in the 60s. And he went to Silverstone to watch as a spectator and was completely captivated and decided he would become a racing driver. And in fact, he raced in the very same race that Jim Clark was killed in Germany. And then he started a race team called March. And from there, he got to meet Bernie, and the two of them then, you know, started to plot. They realized that they could construct a sport which had rules and regulations and safety, because what perhaps youngsters don't realize is just how extraordinary the death toll was. Mm. And they both had very close friends who were killed at the track, and not just one or two, but many, many, many friends who were killed at the track. And between them, they constructed Formula One as we know it today.
What was the reaction like then, from the old guard, as it was, to these young Turks, as they were back then, coming up and saying, right, this is how you're going to run the deal. This is how we're going to organise Formula One. I'm going to control the TV rights. Do you think it's fair to say that they had no idea, the old guard, of the potential that was, you know, behind these, quote-unquote, I mean, I use it advisedly, modern gladiators going out there every weekend to risk their lives and bring home the spoils?
Well, the Blazers were very sort of thrown by these aggressive youngsters who were determined to get control of the sport. And there was a tremendous, in the 80s, there was a tremendous battle between Bernie and the teams on one side, and I'd say mainly the British teams, because the other extraordinary thing about Formula One is that it's a very Brit-centric sport. I don't think any other sport is controlled from one country in the way that Formula One is. And the Blazers, who were mainly based in France and Monaco, of course, they were very anti-Bernie, and there was a lot of political shenanigans went on. But gradually Bernie got his way, and because the strength of Formula One had devolved from pre-war, mainly the Italians and the French, and sporadically the Germans, it had devolved to Britain, where we had all the great teams, Lotus, Cooper, BRM, then McLaren, Frank Williams later on, you know, and it became something that they could not control. And eventually Bernie and then Max, who stood to be president of the FIA, which is the governing body, when he became president, they really held all of the cards. And that's how they took control.
And what was, I was going to say, because before, wasn't it FISA, wasn't it, which was the French, or the French run organisation, and that was Jean-Marie Balès, wasn't he?
And Max stood against Balès in an election. And Bernie being Bernie, Balès thought he was going to win this thing hands down. But Bernie being Bernie went round in all of the smoke-filled rooms and tapped up all of the delegates who were going to vote. And by the morning of the vote, he had all of the guys on his side. Boris Johnson could do with him right now, just to secure the Brexit, the Tory party vote. But, you know, that's the way they work. They were extraordinarily clever and savvy in a way that I don't think anybody had seen before. And that's the way Bernie operated. He was such... He's not educated in any sense, really, but he's just such an incredibly clever man. I mean, one story goes back to when he was a car dealer, and he'd been stitched up by one of his mates, and so he decided to return the favour. And he went to see this guy, and he said, "Do you fancy a Mercedes SL hardtop?" And the guy said, "Yeah, how much?" And he said, £300 to you." And the guy said, "Well, that's very cheap." He said, "Well, you know, it's up to you. You know, you can take it or leave it." Well, the guy said, "Yes," handed over the readies, and Bernie said, "I'll deliver it tomorrow morning." And sure enough, he did. When the guy looked out of his window, there on the pavement was the hard top for a Mercedes SL, not the car, just the hard top, because he always operated to the letter of the deal, not more, not less, to the letter. And people who weren't quite as cute as him would never quite recognise that.
You talk about the operating to the letter of the deal. I mean, is it fair to say that Bernie isn't... I mean, he loves the deal, he loves the atmosphere, he loves the girls who come along with Formula One, but he's not exactly a great fan. I mean, when he was running his operations from the motorhome that was called the Kremlin, nicknamed the Kremlin, I mean, Bernie would quite frequently leave before the Grand Prix had finished.
Yeah, I don't think it's... He has a curious attitude to things. He is a fan. I mean, he is steeped, absolutely steeped in Formula One, and I would say there's probably not a man on the planet who knows more about it than him, and he goes all the way back to Enzo Ferrari. I mean, he has known every driver, every key figure in the sport, going way back into the 50s. But he just has a very peculiar method of operating, and he would always, as soon as the race started, he'd get in his private jet, fly home, and then he would watch it in the comfort of his own home. He didn't really like watching at the track very much, but he absolutely adored the characters in Formula One, and so he was steeped in it. And as I said to you earlier, I mean, he watched two of his best friends die in cars.
Archie Scott Brown and Jochen Rindt, presumably, yeah?
Stuart Lewis Evans.
Lewis Evans, sorry, yeah.
And Jochen Rindt. And, you know, he was very, very close to Jochen Rindt. Indeed, they were like brothers. So he knows all about the ups and downs. And if you ever talk to anybody who's been involved in anything, you know, I can think back to Jules Bianchi a couple of years ago, for 2015, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When he was eventually fatally injured in Japan. And if you talk to the guys at Marussia, who were the team that Jules drove for, they'll tell you that Bernie was on the phone every day. Whatever they wanted, he could get it. If they needed clearance on visas, he would get it. If they needed a plane, he would get it. If they needed paperwork, he would get it. He was right behind them every step of the way. You know, he's a hard man, but he's got a soft centre. You just have to go and find it.
Mm. I'm so just remember, it's 2014, Jules Bianchi. But again, that goes to doesn't that go back to Stuart Lewis Evans, because, you know, it took Stuart, sadly, he did a couple of days to die from his burns, didn't it, from his injuries in Morocco?
Yeah, I think it was 5 days or something. Mm. And they were the same age. I mean, they were like brothers. And Bernie provided Stuart Lewis Evans's cars, and he drove the same Connell himself. They were very, very close. And Bernie, you know, ushered in this age of great entrepreneur team owners like Ron Dennis, Frank Williams, Eddie Jordan, all very recognisable names now, who themselves then went on to build these incredible teams. I mean, Ron Dennis started with four mechanics as a young fella and ended up with a company that employed 3,000 people. These guys, proper, you know, real entrepreneurs, real trailblazers.
So how did you come to write the book? I mean, you said you've been involved covering motorsport and covering Formula One for a while now. Did you go back over interviews you'd done? Did you speak to people who were willing to speak about Bernie and Max and the way Formula One has developed? And did you actually speak to the man himself about this particular project?
Yes, I mean... It was one of those things, you know, every dinner party, every walk into a pub would be people saying, "Oh, what's Michael Schumacher like?" Or, "What's that poison dwarf Bernie Eccleston like?" You know, and that sort of thing. And I got to the stage where I thought, well, I'm going to have to try to write something. And then it occurred to me that nobody had really written, not a history, but a sort of narrative about Formula One that wasn't dry as dust. And working for the Times, I had the sort of seat at the top table over 20-odd years meeting these chaps. So I had a fund of my own anecdotes and stories and events. But then I went round all of them, and we spent time together. You know, I spent a day in Italy with Luca Montezemolo, the ex-president of Ferrari, who's great, great figure in Formula One, and rescued Ferrari, in fact, from bankruptcy and leaving the sport. And we had dinner together with our wives and all that sort of stuff. And Bernie and I had a few lunches, and Max, and we went over old times and, you know, tried to remember stuff from the past. And it was a great catch-up. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And, you know, all the stories then poured out, and they are just such fascinating men. And what I wanted to show was not the men that people saw on TV, who could be rather straight and somewhat severe. And Bernie, you know, is very gnomic sometimes, mainly because he's deaf. TV interviewers ask him questions. He has no idea what they're saying to him. So he just answers his own questions sometimes. So I wanted people to see behind the curtain and to see what these chaps were like at home and what they did away from the track. And, you know, for instance, Luca Montezemolo started a train company in Italy, a high-speed train company. A couple of days before I went to see him in Rome, he sold it for €2.5 billion. Bernie, now he's out of Formula One, has bought a coffee plantation in Brazil, and his wife has started a coffee company. You know, they all have a hinterland, and I wanted the book to show that hinterland and show that they weren't these one-dimensional characters, but they do all share this extraordinary quality, which is the single-minded focus and energy, which is quite extraordinary, and built this global billion-pound industry.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because if you look at the way since Bernie left the sport and since Max left the sport and Luca, it's that if you look at the way that that Liberty have handled it with... It seems to be, I mean, it's an American company. F1, you can argue, is very much a European business model. And the way that they, you know, always, they focus on kids on the grid. They focus on the backstory. They love the human story. And it's the sort of thing that Bernie probably sort of shakes his head at and says, just get on with the something racing.
Yeah, Bernie's ultimately a racer. And I went to see Chase Carey, the head of Liberty, who bought the sport, and let's be honest, they bought it at peak price, $8 billion. I mean, that's, you know, from something that was, you know, turn up when you like and some prize money in a brown envelope to an $8 billion sale is the most extraordinary thing. But I went to see Chase Carey and the chief exec at Liberty not long after it had taken over, and he said, you know, what I want to do is get rid of the soap opera that's Formula One. And I said to him, but that is Formula One, it is a soap opera. It has been for 70 years, this amazing story of Enzo Ferrari refusing to talk to Frank Williams and Bernie Eccleston trying to get money out of somebody. And, you know, the backstory of Formula One's been almost as fascinating as the stuff that happens on the track. And, yeah, I mean, the Americans are bringing an American eye to it, but I think they're struggling to comprehend the way that Formula One works. And you know what? I wouldn't want to be them, because it's a very difficult time for Formula One, because the sport faces an existential crisis, I think, because of the environmental push. You know, what is it going to be, not next year or the year after, but in 10 or 20 years? Is it going to be electric? Is it going to be hydrogen? Is it not going to happen at all? What will Formula One be? And the last chapter of the book, I could try to address that problem, because the age of the entrepreneur, Frank Williams, Ron Dennis, Bernie Eccleston, Max Mosley, Eddie Jordan, all these people, is over. And the big corporations have moved in. Mercedes, Red Bull, these guys now run the sport. And what will Formula One be? Will it return to its roots? Will it become a sport for entrepreneurs again? Nobody seems to know which direction it's going to go, and it's going to be a fascinating few years, I think.
I mean, it's always been the thing with Formula One. It's always been the shop front for the latest in technologies and the latest latest adaptations or whatever for cars, and some of it's sort of back to road safety. But yeah, if as the world becomes more environmentally friendly, I mean, we've already seen Formula E making big inroads. We know that Liberty have a fondness for street circuits as well, because they like the backdrop to have it, you know, racing part, to have Silverstone replaced by a London Grand Prix has always been on the cars, and a Rome Grand Prix. So it's going to be very interesting to see where it goes. One thing is for sure though, if you look at the Formula One champions, say, in the mid-60s and what they earned, and somebody like Lewis, and you only have to say Lewis, and half the world know exactly that you're talking about a talented young driver from Stevenage.
Yeah, he's done well, hasn't he? I first met Lewis when he was about 14 at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, and there was a rather surly teenager staring back at me as we were trying to talk. And then in 2006, I remember saying during that season, I wrote a big piece at Silverstone saying this guy has to come into F1. He slightly proved it that afternoon in the GP2 race.
Ah, the famous overtaking manoeuvre on peak.
The one tier down from Formula One. He did a 3 abreast.
Yeah, going to Stowe.
At about 160 miles an hour. coming from the back of the field to win it. You know, and I've watched him develop and grow, and he's had his ups and downs and his bad moments and his highs and his lows. But I tell you what, without him, the sport would be very, very poor indeed, because he's such a personality, and he crosses the divide between Formula One and show business in a way that I'm actually struggling to think of any sportsman that crosses that divide in the way that he does. And he's probably the only Formula One driver that people properly would recognise, I suspect, in this country, maybe Jenson Button, but you know, outside of those two, it would be difficult to think of anybody who's as famous as him. And strangely, where I live, about 5 miles that way, is his family home. Anthony, his dad, lives just over the A1 from me. We bump into each other occasionally and have a natter. He's a terrific role model, and he's done a great job, Lewis, and he may be able to lay claim to being the greatest of them all, I think.
We will wait and see after his performance in Silverstone. 6 Grand Prix, British Grand Prix victories, tying him in with the great Jim Clark. The book is called Driven, The Men Who Made Formula One. It's by Kevin Easton. Kevin, if people want to find out more about the book or about yourself, is there a website? Do you do your own website or social media?
No, I don't. I'm on Twitter, which is EastonF1. Hodder and Stoughton are the publisher. It's quite easy to find. It's on Amazon. It's in Waterstones. It's in the airports. It's just come out in paperback about 2 weeks ago, and I think it's going on sale in America any time now, America and Canada. So it's in Australia, so it's pretty universal now.
But as the great Murray...
A rattling good read.
A rattling good read. I should be rattling off to read it, because, you know, as you can probably tell, I'm a racing nut. As the great Murray Walker said, anything can happen in Formula One, and it usually does. The one thing that is true is... It's such a great sport. There's such a wide variety of things that can go on. Such great personalities. You know, love it or loathe it, you can't keep your eyes off Formula One, can you?
No, it just... Actually, a final anecdote about Murray himself. It was the anniversary of his first commentating stint at the British Grand Prix, 1949. And they put him in a wooden cabin out on the outer edge of the circuit, where he had his notes. And he was looking through a you know, the sort of window of the box. But he had no idea what was going on. And the guy who became known as Motormouth, as you know, he always had something to say. His first commentating stint, a guy called John Boater came along in an ERA car, and he went off, and the car actually somersaulted all the way towards Murray's box, and Boater was thrown out and landed bleeding at Murray's feet. And all he could think of to say was, "And Boater's gone off." And that was it. He couldn't think of anything else to say. Very tragic for him, but there we are.
Indeed. The book is called Driven, The Men Who Made Formula One. It's by Kevin Easton. Kevin, it's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Thanks for that.